Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Mark and Amanda from Hutan.
Bonjour.
Hello.
Thank you both for taking the time to join us today. I'm super excited to jump into all the work that you guys are doing at Hutan, and I would love for you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself. And Mark, how did you first become interested in orangutans and wildlife conservation? And what brought you to inspire the co-founding of Hutan? And Amanda, what brought you to join Hutan?
So I'm going to start because I just don't know why I have always been willing to work with wild animals in wild places. I am originally from Paris in France. That's why earlier I said bonjour. Sure, I should have said selamat pagi. This is a way we say hi here in Malaysia. So yeah, since I am a kid, I always wanted to be with why, I don't know, maybe I went to the zoo when I was very early, and I remember that since I was very, very, very young, I just spent my time looking at animals in the backyard. I was spending my time reading stuff about wildlife. So anyway, it's a passion I never lost. And this led me to work first in Africa, Saudi Arabia, places like that. And 30 years ago, I ended up in Borneo. Borneo is an amazing place for wildlife, people. Biodiversity we have here on this island is just not believable. It's unbelievable. You have to come to see it. It's a paradise for naturalists like me. So that's why actually when I started to work in Borneo, I didn't think that I would stay more than 2-3 years, and 30 years later, here I am, still there.
Incredible. And Amanda.
Okay, so I am Malaysian, born and raised in a small town in Sabah, which is called Sandakan, and it's 2 hours away from our study site, the field site that we are located in. So few years back then, for my internship, I was looking for an organization that focused on conservation work. Back then, I only knew about ex situ conservation, either research-based conservation. So interestingly, when I stumble upon Hutan, their approach is community-based conservation. Coming from a zoology background, I was not familiar with this concept. So I did my internship and the rest is history. 8 years has passed and I now work in Hutan as a scientific officer, but I also get the privilege of working alongside my colleagues in monitoring and research.
So you have been with Hutan for 8 years, Amanda?
Yes, it's wow. So short. It feels like it was just 2 months ago. Still got a lot of things to learn.
Well, time flies when you're having fun. Now, from what I researched, the name Hutan means forest in Malay. Is that correct?
Correct.
How does this reflect the mission of the organization when it comes to the balance of wildlife conservation with the human needs? You mentioned the community work in Borneo. So I'd love for you to break down the mission for our audience and how you guys balance this aspect when it comes to conservation work.
Yeah, let me take this question a little bit and I will give you my perspective, because when we created Hutan, I say we, it was Isabelle Lachman, another French primatologist, and myself, so it was more than 30 years ago, we're really looking hard for a word that would capture our interest. Our interest was to protect orangutan, to protect wildlife in general. But of course, protecting a species like orangutan, this is not just about saving the animals themselves. It's about saving their entire world, their entire ecosystem. And if we speak about orangutan, as you just said, means people of the forest. To survive, they need forest. In addition to this, when we are working with orangutan, we are not just saving one species. Because as we all know, orangutans are an umbrella species. So when we work with orangutan, trying to save the orangutan, we are actually saving zillions of species of animals that are sharing the same habitat, the tropical forest. So you could think about all the insects, the birds, the mammals, the reptiles that don't get the same attention as the orangutans. But if we want to maintain a thriving ecosystem, we also need them. So that's why we also decided to go for the orangutan as a charismatic species. Because since the very beginning, what we wanted to do was not to only save the orangutan, but the entire ecosystem. And of course, we cannot forget, forests are not only for wildlife, they are also for us. We need the forest for clean air, for clear water and so forth. So for us at UTAN, Isabel and I, we really thought, let's try something big, let's try something holistic. And even if our entry point was the orangutan, we decided to call our organization UTAN, UTAN, which means the world or the ecosystem we're interested in.
Amazing. I love the absolutely conceptual story that you built there around the start of the mission and the wildlife conservation that has brought you here. Amanda, I'd love for you to talk about the human needs, the community aspect that you said that you've come to the organization learning more about, coming from your zoology background. How has this kind of changed or developed your perspective of conservation and the interaction with human needs and community needs?
Well, first things first, the colleagues that I'm working in, they all come from the local community, Sungai community, in a village called Sukau. And this village is adjacent to the protected forest. And who are more better people to take care of the wildlife and the ecosystem besides the people who are living side by side?
So, absolutely.
During internship, I was fortunate to meet with all of the units, get to learn about their work better, and I realized that not one unit is better than the other, but instead it's complementary towards each other's strength and their needs so that everybody can move forward in their own respective mission. And I guess we're going to be talking about more about what are the stuff that UTAN does, but I think the knowledge that everyone carries organically and naturally, I think that's what fascinates me the most and even humbles me as a student back then, even as a graduate. So yes.
Wow, I love that. So Mark, you mentioned that this has been a 30-year journey for you, and Amanda, you've been on this journey for 8 years, which is both a very large, extensive periods of time. I would kind of want to dive into here what pivotal moments or challenges have led to the expansion of UTAN into more of this comprehensive conservation program, something that Amanda has been able to join 20 years after the start of it for you, Mark. How has your strategy evolved over the years?
To be very honest with you, we didn't have any strategy when we started this project. We just, Isabel and I just decided, okay, let's go to Borneo, do something for orangutan, work with people, and we were just completely open-minded. But the thing is, something I really didn't know at this time is that when we first arrived in Sukau, so Sukau is the name of the village where our project is based, we quickly realized something super important. Actually, the local people, they didn't see orangutan the way we did. You know, in the West, orangutans are such an iconic species, and I was assuming that it was the same for everyone. Actually, we arrive in this community, we start to tell people we want to work with orangutan, and people look at us, what? Why you guys are coming from so far away, France, to study orangutans? Have you lost your mind? These kind of things. Because for them, orangutans was not valued the same. They were more looking at orangutan as a source of troubles because they had to share the same forest with these animals, and orangutans, for example, they love to eat durian fruits. So they would come every year and they would destroy the entire crops of people. The local communities had a lot of issues with another species, the elephant. So when we were trying to tell them, let's go and protect the orangutan, first of all, they didn't understand why we should protect the orangutan. And more importantly, they were telling us, well, orangutan, we don't really care. The problem we have is elephants, because elephants come, they destroy the graveyards, they play with the tombs and the graves of our ancestors. This is a real problem. And you can imagine, if an elephant comes to a graveyard and destroys the graves from your family, you are not going to be so happy. This made us think a lot. And conservation is not at all to tell people what they should do or what they should protect and how. It's more a process where you have to listen to the people you want to work with. You have to try to understand their aspirations, their concerns, their problems, their day-to-day lives. And then, only then, when you start to really understand the community you want to work with, you can bring forward your conservation input, your conservation agenda, and to really work together to address this problem and find solutions together. So for example, and I will let Amanda answer or elaborate on this, for us at UTAN, to protect orangutan, sometimes we take very, very, very parallel areas. At some point, we decided to work with fishermen. And you would tell me, well, fishermen and orangutan, what is the link? Well, this was the thing. We realized that fishermen at this time, 25 years ago, they would use a lot of bark, tree bark, to build their traps. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, we would tell people, protect the forest, protect the trees for the orangutan, for wildlife, for your own survival. And the fishermen would tell us, well, I need the bark, because with the bark I can build my fish trap, and then I can make a living to sustain my family. And so we saw here a real issue. So working with fishermen, understanding their needs, their point of view, we designed new types of traps that didn't use the bark of the trees anymore. And this program was very successful, and we estimate that through this approach, we saved, the fishermen saved maybe 1 million or even more trees over the years. And these trees are, of course, used by orangutan and other species. Mm. My point is that to save a species, to protect a species, we really need to look at a big picture.
Absolutely. You have to have that holistic overview. And Amanda, yes, I'd love to hear about how things have changed during your time there.
Well, during my time when I first entered, there were a lot of... Initially, I thought hutan is actually focusing only on orangutans. But like Mark mentioned, Hutan has been overseeing this conservation effort in a bigger picture. And like he mentioned as well, back then during the peak time of putting priorities on orangutan research, everybody is actually affected with the presence of elephants that were in the village, which causes a lot of indirect damages on their crops, graveyards. And Hutan, I think, for Mark as well as Isabel and the teams, they listen. This is an issue, even though if it's not focusing upon orangutans. So Hutan established this unit. This initially it was Human Wildlife Conflict Mitigation Unit, but it changed into Elephant Control Unit, where this unit specifically, their main role is to help out in strategizing and providing solutions in mitigating elephants to reduce conflicts that we have in the village. And from this efforts, after a few years, even engaging with the local communities, letting them know you cannot simply put up electric fences however you like. We need to strategize in a way that the elephants can move back to the forest safely and not cause a lot of damages. It reduces conflict. And like Mark said, Hutan listened. We try to collaborate and work with them. Conflicts are reduced and we have a good rapport with the villagers. But I think with Mark's experience and Hutan's experience, it takes decades to establish trust.
Fantastic. I am so excited to dive into some more questions with you guys, but we're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach. Here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Mark and Amanda from Hutan. We just left off going through the history of how Hutan was established, the passions that led Mark to co-found the organization, and the studying of conservation and the community aspect that really brought Amanda to it to thrive in the organization as well. Now, climate change is affecting the entire globe, guys. How is this affecting orangutans and other wildlife in Borneo? What steps are Hutan taking to build resilience?
Resilience is really the key word here, because as we all know, climate change is happening. It's not a distant threat. This is happening right now. Right now, as we speak, we see all, wherever we are, all these changes. So in our case, in the tropical forest of Borneo, we see, for example, that the fruiting patterns are changing. So the forest sometimes is not producing the fruit that it used to produce. And of course, it creates a new situation for people of the forest, for the orangutan and for other animals who feed on fruit. Wildlife need to answer to that. Wildlife is resilient, but what we also see more and more, and I think it's a trend that is going to generalize increasingly, and which is very worrying to me, is that more and more, at least some of these species, they understand that if the pattern of the forest is changing, there are some other types of production nearby, like plantation, like agricultural landscapes, like villages, that offer alternative sources of food. And so because of these changes in the climate pattern, we see more and more often animals like elephants, like orangutans in our case, going into people's land, people's crop, agricultural landscape, which in itself is not a big problem, except that it creates conflict. And if people are not willing or able to accept this new situation, we end up in a big problem. So I think we will come back to this concept of coexistence, because to me, the essential factor to consider when we speak about climate changes. And then I would like to say as well that, of course, the climate is changing, although in Borneo, sometimes you hear about El Nino, about forest fire in the island. We also have La Nina events where the places is completely flooded. Just finishing a flood that lasted for 3 weeks at our site. So for 3 weeks, we're underwater. First time ever that this has been seen in the region. So all of this, I mean, have to make us think about all of this changing world. To me, conservation, as we discussed about conservation, is not about the species itself. It's about building resilience. This resilience needs to be built with the communities, with the ecosystem, needs to also be built within the organization. Resilience, as Neil just mentioned to me, is an essential concept if we want to survive the climate crisis that comes. Having said that, and I stop on this issue, resilience is something that is part of nature. The natural world, by definition, is resilient. So the game is not lost. We just need to learn how to be more resilient ourselves.
Okay, fantastic. So Borneo has been a site known for much deforestation, particularly related to palm oil. Now, I want to know what lesser known threats are threatening Bornean wildlife and orangutans or elephants, and how are Hutan addressing issues like this? I know you've already alluded a bit to the human wildlife conflict regarding them having that adaptability with the change in forest production of food and them going into plantations. But what are lesser known threats that they're facing, and how are those causing different forms of human-wildlife conflict as well?
Okay, so let me backtrack a little bit.
Yes, that was a lot of us. That was quite a loaded question.
No, it's a very good question. But for those of us who are not really familiar with Borneo, Borneo is big. Borneo is the third largest island in the world, and Borneo is split within three different countries. So on Borneo Island, you have Malaysia, Brunei, and Indonesia. Part of Malaysia, part of it. And it's very important to remember this, because depending on where we are, in Borneo, we are in a different countries at a different stage of development. So you're right, Neil. I mean, deforestation in Borneo has been fierce in the past, especially in the Malaysian part of the island. Now in Malaysia, so we are in the state of Sabah, deforestation is not really an issue anymore. Most deforestation has passed. If you move to Kalimantan, the Indonesian part of Borneo, there is still deforestation happening because Indonesia is still in the process of developing their economy much more than Malaysia. Malaysia did it before. So deforestation is not something, unfortunately, that happens only in Borneo. It's a process that has been happening and is still happening worldwide. So it's true that we have lost tens of thousands of hectares, millions of hectares of forest because of human development. A lot of these forests were replaced by oil palm plantation, you mentioned that, but also by other types of commodities. So now, if we speak about other types of threat, this is where it's becoming very interesting. In the Malaysian part of the island, Sabah or Sarawak, as I said, deforestation is not really an issue anymore, but what we have as a major issue for the future is what we call fragmentation. The landscape has been fragmented because of past human activities, and if we think of it, fragmentation is a real problem we also are facing in the Western world. In the UK, in Europe, the major issues faced by biodiversity nowadays is fragmentation. The landscape is fragmented, the populations are fragmented, and when the animals need to move across the landscape, they cannot remain within the network of protected forests. They have to leave these protected areas and go into people's lands, which creates problems. So the problems that we are facing here because of fragmentation, and I'm sure Amanda is going to give some example about how Hutan is addressing some of these issues. The problem we are facing here in Borneo about fragmentation is very similar in terms of concept than what wildlife is facing in places like the UK, like Europe, like North America. The landscape is too fragmented. A new threat. I don't, of course, speak about the threat of fires and this or flood. These are natural threats that are, of course, even getting worse because of the climate change we just talked about.
Yes, a lot of these compound problems, absolutely.
But something which to me, as by training, I used to be veterinarian, so something I'm quite interested in is to look at these new landscapes. We were mentioning agricultural landscape, where you have villages, dogs, pets, and stuff like this. And I said earlier that animals, or we will talk about it later, animals are going into this kind of landscape. Well, these new landscapes bring new types of threats, like, for example, disease transmission. Maybe orangutans or other species could contract disease from people or their domestic animals that they find in close contact in this non-forest habitat. So electrical power line or road system, these are new threats for these animals. It's, of course, linked to fragmentation. As you said, the word compound, it's really a compound effect, a compound threat. But these threats are real in the new era we are entering now with all this major transformation of the natural ecosystem.
You've just mentioned there the fragmentation of the habitat throughout particularly the side of Borneo that you guys are working on. And I know that you guys have pioneered these artificial bridges and these hornbill nest boxes. Obviously, we've talked about the multitude of wildlife that you guys are working with in Borneo. Can you guys explain how these particular innovations have helped wildlife navigate these now fragmented habitats?
Sure, I'll take this question. So as Mark mentioned, particularly in Borneo, most of the forests that we have here in the place that we are working are heavily degraded due to logging in the early 80s and even fragmented from development of settlements as well as oil palm plantations. So years back, understanding that orangutans cannot swim, this fragmentation are the biggest threat for the orangutans. So collaborating with our zoo partners back then, there is an idea, an innovation to try out to set up artificial bridges to allow orangutans to move across fragmented habitat to increase genetic diversity and also to avoid a population bottleneck. And we set up camera traps just to see if the orangutans are keen in trying out the bridges. And
yes,
it took such a long time. I think it took years. We have an amount full of macaque selfie, but it took years until orangutans, they took their time to kind of be comfortable and start using that bridge. And it is, like I've mentioned, it is not only orangutans that benefit from these bridges, but also primates such as macaques and the endemic proboscis monkeys that we have here in Borneo.
Amanda, sorry, just there, you've mentioned the genetic bottlenecks and you wanting to maintain the diversity of the species. Can you mention that more in layman's terms for our general listeners so they can really understand the importance of why these bridges are key to preserving these populations?
I'll try to give a rough picture. Well, if let's just say we have a site that is isolated from everyone else and everybody do not have a chance to mate or pair, and in the end you only meet up with your own siblings or your own cousins or brothers, with this corridor or even a bridge for them to move to the other side, they are able to expand their genetic diversity instead of being isolated and retaining the genetic that they have within their compartment. Mark, if you'd like to add.
Yes, I would like to just add something on this. Actually, 30 years ago when we started the work, the first thing we did was to do a population survey of the population of the orangutan in Kinabatangan. Yeah. And with one of our colleagues, Dr. Wilson.
Find the family groups.
Yeah.
Yes.
Benoit, who used to work with Cardiff University, did a DNA analysis, so a genetic study of this population. And what we found out, and this was very surprising to us, is that there was already a signal of genetic isolation between the different fragments of forests. Forests had been separated from one another just for 20 years maybe, so which is just one generation time for the orangutan. But the scientists were already able to detect a genetic signal here, which means that if we don't do anything because of fragmentation, as Amanda just explained, the genetic signal is going to be more and more, is going to lose diversity. And this is a problem for man. And that's why one of the issues linked with fragmentation is what we also call the genetic fragmentation and genetic isolation. And the need to recreate corridors, so in this case we are talking about orangutan bridges, to allow for the genes, if you want, to just...
to flow.
Move across the landscape, yeah.
Yes.
Spread the love. So moving away from the orangutan bridges, there's also another innovation that Hutan attempted, and this is also thanks to the collaboration that we have with the zoo partners. In general, in Kinabatangan, we have 8 species of hornbills. Now, these birds are considered large at their size, and they require large tree cavities to nest as well as to breed. So, going back as to what Mark and I have mentioned, most of the trees here were previously logged, so the trees that we have along the Kinabatangan River do not stand more than 30 meters in height. That means that they have very small cavities, which is unsuitable for these large birds to find a nest, for them to find a home, and for them to breed and to pair. Adopting the idea of artificial nest boxes from the zoos, we have the experts coming in and collaborated with Hutan's team to design different prototypes of artificial nest box. We set it up along the Kinabatangan River, and like the orangutan bridge, it's not like we put it here today, tomorrow we get visitors. No, it took such a long time until we have detections of hornbills, checking out the crib, mm-hmm. watching it to see if it's a homey, is it something for them to pair? Yeah. And right now I think there are a number of boxes set up, and we have a total of, if I'm not mistaken, 8 pairs of hornbills observed that has nested and created, they have chicks in that artificial nest boxes. And we have species such as rhinoceros hornbills as well as oriental pied hornbills. And at this moment, we are currently working with another local NGO called Explore Gaia that focuses on hornbill conservation projects here in Malaysia.
Incredible. So, yeah. Incredible. It sounds like such great work, and I'm really looking forward to jumping more into that. But on this note, we'll be right back after this short break.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad,
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Mark and Amanda from Hutan. Now, we just spoke about the compounds effect of climate change and habitat fragmentation and the work that Hutan have done to preserve genetic diversity by building artificial bridges within the forestry for wildlife such as the orangutans. Now, Mark, just in the prior section of us talking here, you mentioned the scientific research that you guys were carrying out originally to look at these familial groups of orangutans, and your scientific research has continued throughout the time with Hutan. Now, I want to know, with this alongside the community development, what surprising insights have you gained when it comes to orangutan behavior in these landscapes that are continually being modified by humans?
Well, here's a thought for all of you, for all of us. I will and I would challenge that the orangutan we know today is not the same orangutan that once was. The orangutan we are looking at today has been shaped by 30,000 years of coevolution with a super predator. I say that because people reached Borneo about 30,000 years ago. Before that, no people, but we had around. So here again, the animal we see today in the forest of Borneo or Sumatra is a result of this coevolution. Let's think about it. You all know orangutan in captive settings, in zoos. So why are the wild orangutans we are following, we are studying here in Borneo, so solitary compared to the one you see in captivity, where they are social, playful, live in groups, and do all kind of stuff together? In the wild, they're on their own. In the forest today, they are spending most of their time in the treetop. But here again, in rehab centers, in captivity, they don't want to climb. They stay on the ground. And when scientists like us use camera traps in Borneo, you know what happened? One of the commonest species we catch in our camera traps? Orangutans. This means that when people are not around, these animals are more social, more terrestrial. All of this brings me to the fact that what we expect from our knowledge about the orangutan today, of course we are surprised by the resilience, by the adaptability of the species, but we cannot forget that what we know of the orangutan today is, here again, the result of this coevolution. So, we were talking about human-modified landscapes. To me, it's no surprise that these orangutan are going into this non-forest habitat. Some of the males we know have been walking kilometers and kilometers and kilometers in plantation. There is no tree, they just walk. Some of these animals are building nests on the ground, which is surprising for an orangutan because when people are around, as I said, they stay in the treetops. They are afraid of the predators, of the hunters. But here again, these animals have been through a lot of changes throughout their evolution. Now the forest has changed, the climate is changing. Well, they're gonna adapt, they're gonna adjust their behavior. And here again, we cannot think about the orangutan as something fixed in nature. The orangutan need forest to survive, we all agree on that. But what type of forest the orangutan needs, this is an open question.
Mark, earlier you mentioned that Borneo has this unique geographical landscape where it has the autonomy of three different countries that have land on this incredible third largest island in the world that you mentioned. Now, wildlife do not know anything about political boundaries or gate systems or anything like that.
Very, very true.
So you mentioned that Malaysia has progressed past away from mass logging and deforestry. However, it is still currently taking place in the Indonesian part, for example. So from my research, I know that Hutan have a tree nursery and reforestation projects, which do involve local communities. How do you find these efforts restore habitats, also improving livelihoods of local communities, but on the flip side, you may have a country that's maybe 50 miles down the road that has this mass deforestry that you can't have any sort of interaction with. Like, how is that balance taking place on Borneo? I'm super curious because you've got conflicting government bodies and conflicting industries that are effectively being combative in a conservation part and a industry part.
Before Amanda can explain more in details the efforts of our colleagues about reforestation and restoration of the ecosystem, I would like to answer this indeed. You know what? All the countries in the world follow the same pattern. And this applies to European countries, to the UK, to North America, everywhere the same. It's something that is called a deforestation curve. All the countries, when they start their economic development, first thing they will do is to exploit their natural resources. And if in a country you have forest, what you do, you exploit the forest. And so the deforestation rate is quite high, and the size covered with your forest is going to decline, to decline, to decline, to decline, to decline. Meanwhile, development is shaping up, and the development curve is going up. At some point, people start to realize that the cost of deforestation is very high, because of course you have all the compound impact of deforestation, flooding, loss of water quality, change of climate, and this erosion, of course, and this kind of thing. So at some point, the governments, they realize, well, it's time to stop deforesting. And what is really interesting with this model is that all the countries do the same. When the economic development start to plateau, this is when society and governments start to reforest and restore their ecosystem. And if we look at what happened in the Western countries, this is exactly this kind of situation. Malaysia is following the same model. So in Malaysia, in Sabah, at least now, we are in a phase where restoration of the habitat of the forest is taking place. Indonesia is a bit behind. We are still, for this model, behind, meaning that there is still development happening, so deforestation taking place. Just a matter of time. Give 5, 10 years, or I don't know how many years to Indonesia, they will do the same. It's really an interesting socio-economic model that so far has been followed by most countries in the world. So, but yeah, maybe Amanda, you could talk more about all what the efforts done by the teams at UTAN in terms of restoration, reforestation, because you know what? It's really a difficult job to do.
And I am 100% agree to that. In UTAN, under the umbrella of UTAN itself, we not only do orangutan research, but we also have two amazing reforestation teams. So they are an almost all women reforestation team. I do not want to do this one joke where Mark always tells why a reforestation works well with women. Let's just put a earmark on that. So here, as a community-based conservation, the reforestation teams here, of course, when there is a land procured to be planted, the places that they're planted is usually to establish corridors and to connect fragmented forests along the Kinabatangan River that was previously heavily degraded. Hutan itself, we have our own nursery to gather acquired native tree seedlings from local families in the village. Now, these seedlings are cared until they have an optimum growth before they are brought to the site to be planted. Now, this is the biggest task, and I feel like I have my utmost respect to them, because work does not stop right after you plant trees.
Yes,
you have,
yes.
You know, like all of these campaigns where we have like, you plant a million trees, you're doing good for the planet. No, no. It takes a lot of work, because the main objective, of course, is to ensure the survival rate of the trees that you've planted. And for us here in Hutan, we try to ensure that they have an optimum survival rate more than 70%. Mm-hmm. And this takes continuous work of 3 to 4 years.
I don't think people realize how many international reforestry events have failed. Yeah. Like, it's insane.
It's unspoken.
It's another debate altogether, but it's very true. We all need to realize that planting a tree is the easy part. And Amanda mentioned that earlier. With our experience at UTAN, we started with a team of men. It was a complete failure. Why? Because men can plant trees, no problem. But maintaining,
just caring for the tree.
Exactly. This sense of nurturing the tree, taking care of the same seedlings, coming back to it, This is where our team of guys, they were completely useless, sorry to say that. And since we changed our approach and now we are working mostly with women from the village, it's a success.
It's about finding the people that can get the job done. If they're doing it well enough, like, that's right, this is their job, they can do it, they're going to succeed, and then it's going to be done well. It's very similar to an organization that I worked with in Costa Rica and that I've also been on this show. The listeners may have heard of them before, the McCaw Recovery Network, MRN. They worked with a range of women rangers. So I visited their site in Costa Rica, and obviously their women rangers are very similar to the project that you're doing, Amanda, bringing in, doing the seedlings on their restoration site, bringing them out, and then ensuring their success rates. Yeah, so it's fantastic to see this project, these types of projects working internationally, figuring out what works well and ensuring its future success.
Additional to restoring habitats is also an opportunity for them to increase their skills, not only to plant trees and also to identify species. They are experts. Mm-hmm. They are experts. They know by their scientific name, all of the Latin names. They're good. Yes. But we are also diving into research in understanding how much biomass of this restored habitats based on their hard work that they have been doing for the past 10 years. So this, I guess, provides them the empowerment to not only see that the trees that they are growing, but also to understand the science behind it. Uh-huh. And besides improving, to supplement knowledge for the teams, we also improve livelihoods by acquiring seedlings from local families who run home nurseries. So for foundations and donors that support reforestation work to Hutan, their support directly goes to the ground.
Yes, and it also gives them that sense of ownership as well.
Exactly. And I just would love for all of you guys to be able to see the joy, the love these teams they express and they feel when you are in the field in a plot that was reforested, let's say 6, 10, 20 years ago, and the way they talk about their seedling, they remember when they planted them, they remember what kind of issues these seedlings had, and oh my gosh.
Of course.
They are just amazing.
It's like a childlike connection, you know. Exactly. I don't know, there was this thing in the UK where they would be like, oh, you plant like an apple seed and you can grow and see, but like, oh, that's my tree. But it's that element, but en masse. I completely see that. So we've been talking here about reforestry, but I, through my research, found out that your team discovered that orangutans can survive in degraded forests. Is that correct? How has this influenced your conservation strategies beyond protected areas?
I let Mark answer this.
Excellent, excellent, excellent question. Actually, the reason why we started Hutan 30 years ago, Isabel and myself, was to try to understand if orangutan could survive in disturbed forest. Why? Because 30 years ago, the mantra from everybody was clear. Orangutans cannot survive in disturbed forest. They need primary intact forest to survive. However, when we came to Sabah, completely different scenario here, because all the forests were already badly logged, overdegraded, and we saw orangutan nests in many, many places that we were not expecting them to be. So we are like, how come the orangutan in Sabah, are they different? Why are they surviving in this disturbed forest? Because people don't expect them there. And so we started to really study if orangutan could survive and adjust their ecology to disturbed forests. Actually, it was a very important question, considering that today, 75-80% of the remaining wild orangutans in Borneo are surviving in forests that have been or that are exploited by people. So very few populations are found in intact forests. Why? Because there is very few intact forests left on the island. But more importantly, 30 years ago, people thought, well, scientists say that a disturbed forest has no use for wildlife, no use for biodiversity, so let's convert it to something else, like oil palm plantation, rubber plantation, whatever. For us, it was essential to show that no, even if the forest has been exploited for timber, it still retains a value for biodiversity. 30 years later, as of today, everybody recognizes that. But 30 years ago, it was a completely different mindset. So the game is changing again in 2025, because not only orangutan can survive and thrive in disturbed forests, they are now moving into this mosaic landscape, into farmlands. Okay? Mm-hmm. A lot of people say it's not possible, it's not viable. who says so? So at Utan, we really want to try to understand if orangutan could survive in this mosaic landscape. Yeah. What are their needs? Because this is important to know. I mean, orangutans are going into plantation. We like it or not, they are there. So we need to really understand why they are there, what do they do, what do they need, to really try to manage the landscape better, to give them a chance to survive in this mosaic landscape. So the question is not if they are going to coexist in this landscape, but how they're going to do it. And so far, Utan is really pushing hard towards this, to better understand this situation, because I do think it's an essential element of the conservation strategies to save the orangutan in the long term. We need to understand what's happening outside of the forest habitat, outside of the protected forest.
Incredible. Guys, we have flown through the conversation here today. There are so many more questions I would love to ask you, but we are so tight on time. So that being said, I would love to hear from both of you, what have been Hutan's or your own proudest achievements in, let's say, the past 5 years within the organization? And I'd love for you to then end on where people can learn more about Hutan and maybe what your final message of about conserving Borneo's biodiversity or combating climate change that there is.
Can I go first? For me, very, very briefly, my major pride is our teams of more than 100 people, all from the village. They are the real heroes of the story. They are the one who are fighting hard to protect their natural resources. They are the real conservationists. And this is what Hutan is really proud of. To know that from very, very tiny teams, we have achieved all of this, and to see how this team is flourishing is just, wow, inspiring. And for all the auditors who are listening, something, don't give up. Conservation is about coexistence. Coexistence is a concept that we all need to apply. Here in Borneo, with elephants, orangutan, crocodiles, whatever, there where you are, think about what is in your backyard. Coexist with them. Think about what is in your house, spider, mice, or whatever. Coexist with these animals. If we cannot coexist with wildlife, there is no hope. But the thing is, as we said earlier, nature is resilient, and we have to learn to coexist again with all these animals. And then there is a chance. Amanda, I leave it to you, the last word of the discussion.
Can I say I'm just in for the ride? I'm kidding. So for the...
No, that's great. It's passionate. You're like, I'm just here for the ride. I'm here to save some species. I'm here to save the world. That's what Amanda's about.
No.
Super Amanda to the rescue.
No. Well, I think working alongside with my colleagues here in Hutan, it creates it beams my
heart. A fullness,
heart.
Yeah.
A fullness, exactly, Neil. A fullness because we are all locals. We are all coming from different backgrounds, of course. We are in a I learned the idea of community and I adapt the idea of community and I love the idea of community, especially in going forward onto something, especially in conservation. So to be working alongside my colleagues who I've seen throughout my years in Hutan, who have grown, who have progressed, who back then didn't have confidence and now they have the confidence to actually justify why they do what they do. That for me is pride. And to see my friends, my colleagues, I would say, who are very shy and now they are presenting at conferences in front of international audiences. That's what I'm proud of. To see my friends.
That's so beautiful.
Colleagues. Yes. Yeah. So I was hoping to see, I think, what was the next question?
I feel like Amanda, I would love for you to tell everyone listening where they can learn more about Hutan.
Well, Hutan is currently revamping our structure in means to say that the information about the work that we do is more accessible for people. So do check out our socials. I'm speaking like a millennial right now. Do check out our socials. We have our Instagram, our Facebook, as well as our website. But... But I think I resonate as well, similarly to Mark, understanding in this world that we are facing a lot of intense, rapid change, especially our global warming, numbers of species are getting more and more extinct. It causes generation like me or even younger than me to be more anxious because we are supposed to figure out everything. My advice would be to say just try and to do small action methods. You don't have to figure out everything. As long as you're in for the ride, for conservation, I think you're doing pretty okay.
Thank you so much for those amazing closing words, Amanda. And thank you for your incredible insight today, Mark. And thank you all for listening today to Our Altered World. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.